From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn. We'll hear from John in just a minute from the Sundance Film Festival. Then, a series called Work in Progress. It's about a queer woman who says Julia Sweeney's androgynous Pat character on SNL ruined her life. Sweeney plays herself in the show.
I was actually happy to do it because I like to meet people whose lives I've ruined and try to start making some kind of amends. And this was the beginning of that opportunity.
And musician and photographer Anthony Wilson combines both of those disciplines for his latest release. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the soulfully authentic A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott in their Academy Award-nominated performances, for consideration in all categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in today for John Horn. John's been shuttling between L.A. and Park City, Utah for the Sundance Film Festival, catching as many screenings and conducting as many interviews as humanly possible. When we spoke this morning, John told me about some of the films people at the festival are talking about the most.
There are a couple of narrative films that are about things that happened around 9/11 that a lot of people have been talking about. One is called The Report. It stars Adam Driver, and it's a look into whether or not the United States was torturing detainees post 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq. And the other one is called Official Secrets, and it's basically this a similar story across the pond where Keira Knightley is playing a British intelligence officer who's looking at to whether or not the reasons that the war was justified were false. So those are, it's a very interesting double bill. And then the other thing that's been really interesting are movies that don't end neatly. A lot of people are talking about Luce, which is a drama about a couple of well-to-do white parents who've adopted a black kid from Africa, and he's now the high school valedictorian. We don't really know whether or not he's as good as he seems or whether or not there's something going on that they don't know about. And then there's another narrative film called The Last Black Man in San Francisco, which is about two friends growing up in San Francisco, and you don't know how much of it is imagined, how much of it is real, how much of it is actually about their friendship or how they wish their friendship was. So I think those are the kinds of basic conversations you hear in line at Sundance, people wrestling with, you know, whether or not a story is true and wrestling with whether or not the truth in the story is important.
So these are some of the movies that are resonating with audiences. But what about buyers? Are there buzz films there as well?
There have been a lot of buzz films, and some of them have sold for a lot of money. And first of all, it's important to step back and say when buyers come to Sundance, they're looking for something that can kind of break through the clutter. You know, these buyers are not big studios. They might be art house imprints of big studios like Fox Searchlight. But they're really looking for movies that are not generic. They're not sequels, they're not remakes, you know, they're not action hero stories. They're looking for movies that can really connect with a certain audience. And it might be an audience that's looking for an original comedy. And that's why a movie like Late Night, which is a movie with Emma Thompson and Mindy Kaling about a female late night talk show host, sold to Amazon for $13 million. Because no studio is making that film. And then the company A24 spent $6 million on a movie called The Farewell, which is a very autobiographical story by writer-director Lulu Wang about visiting her grandmother in China. It stars Awkwafina. It's mostly in Mandarin language. And it's kind of a, I would say, a more authentic version of Crazy Rich Asians. So again, every movie, every festival, every buyer is looking for something a little bit different. But again, it's like, is there something for an audience and an audience that isn't really being served?
So what surprises you, John, or intrigues you about these deals in terms of who's doing the buying and the price tags attached to these projects?
Well, I think what's interesting is how much money Amazon is spending and how much money Netflix is not. Amazon has spent more than $41 million combined on three movies. I mean, right now, there's still a couple of days left to go in the festival, and there may be some deals that have yet to close. But Amazon has been a buyer in past years, but certainly not at this level. Fox Searchlight, which typically has been a big buyer, has not bought anything at a meaningful level. Focus Features has not bought anything at a meaningful level. There have been a number of documentaries that have sold, but so far, the companies that are typically big spenders at Sundance have been relatively quiet.
Well, we can now add Apple to this list. Apple made a purchase of a coming-of-age movie about a Muslim American girl called Hala.
Yeah, and Apple, I mean, Apple is trying to get into the same kind of streaming space, dare I say, that Netflix and Amazon are in. This is a movie that was executive produced by Jada Pinkett Smith. It's written and directed by Minal Baig. She's currently a writer on BoJack Horseman, which might be one of the best shows on television right now. And it's partially in Urdu and partially in English. It's certainly a film that targets an audience that isn't being served. Apple hasn't yet said how it's going to be released, but you have to imagine it's going to be available probably more quickly on your phone than it will be in a theater.
And so when do you think the rest of us rank and file moviegoers will have an opportunity to see some of the movies that we've been talking about?
Well, sometimes soon and sometimes we don't know. I mean, if a studio buys a film or a streaming service buys a film, there are a lot of things that they have to do. Maybe the film isn't quite finished. Maybe they have to go and redo some scenes, add some new music. Then they have to put together an advertising and marketing plan. They have to figure out a release date. So some may not come out till the end of the year. There's some movies that have shown at Sundance that already had distribution. There's a film with Jake Gyllenhaal called Velvet Buzzsaw, a very dark tale about the art world in LA. It'll be on Netflix in the next couple of days. Although a lot of the other movies will be coming out in the fall and the winter of this year.
Finally, John, Sundance has shown some episodic series, including one about the Wu-Tang Clan that's coming to Showtime. And there are others still looking for deals. That includes Work in Progress, starring Julia Sweeney and Abby McEnany, both of whom you'll be talking to in our next segment.
Yeah, I know so much of Sundance historically has been about feature films and documentaries, but the festival is really starting to embrace episodic pilots. So these are maybe half-hour pilots of TV series that don't yet have, in most cases, distribution. They don't have a network. They don't have a streaming service. This is a really fresh and original idea. It's based on Abby McEnany's life, even though it's fictionalized. She calls herself a queer dyke. She's unhappy about her weight and about her relationships. And she gives herself 180 days to turn her life around. And it's really a series, it's really a show about what happens in the first of those 180 days. And you'll hear more about it in just a little bit.
That's The Frame's John Horn. He's wrapping things up at the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. John, thanks so much, and we'll see you soon.
See you, Stephen.
Stay tuned for more of The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the soulfully authentic A Star Is Born, starring Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott in their Academy Award-nominated performances. Now nominated for 8 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Adapted Screenplay. Kenneth Turan of the Los Angeles Times calls it passionate, emotional, and fearless, and AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, for consideration in all categories.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn. And as John just told us, lots of indie filmmakers and plenty of television creators head to Sundance with hopes of securing deals there. Chicago improv comedian Abby McEnany is among them. She's the co-creator, co-writer, and star of Work in Progress, an episodic pilot that premiered at Sundance this week. The series is loosely based on McEnany's life as a queer woman and her struggles with weight, depression, and relationships. Saturday Night Live alum Julia Sweeney plays a key role in the story, along with Pat, the character she created for SNL. Sweeney and Abby McEnany spoke with The Frame's John Horn at Sundance.
Abby, how did the idea come about for this? What was your original inspiration other than your own life?
Right. Well, yeah. The failure of your life. Well, John, that kind of wraps it up. Well, actually, I did a storytelling show in Chicago about 2.5 years ago called Work in Progress, and it was basically just stories about my life. How self-involved is that? Hello. Anyways, and then my friend Tim, we were going to work together on some dumb little videos, and he came, and we were meeting to my show, and then we were meeting the next week anyways. And he was like, hey, why don't we just write a show based on this. And I honestly, it's been something I wanted to do my whole life. I just knew I would want it to do it with somebody. But how do you go up to somebody that you like, trust, respect, love, and want to work with and be like, hey, do you want to donate all your time and energy for something right. about me that might not have any payoff? So he came to me and I was like, yes, please. So that's how it started.
We should say Tim is Tim Mason.
Tim Mason,
the
yes.
director, co-writer, co-creator,
yep.
executive producer
yep.
of this. It's easy to say in most cases that the character is a heightened version of the real person.
Yeah.
Heightened doesn't seem like the right adjective or description here. What would you say it is?
Yeah, people are like, somebody last night was like, so are you as neurotic as your character? I was like, it doesn't even scratch the surface.
It's like, this, I'm trying to be a feminist and I have this like princess, like prince fantasy, like not necessarily a man prince, but I'm like a struggling damsel and f-ing distressed.
I guess I'm a pretty heightened character or personality. Yeah. It's weird. It's like as a fat person stuff, I always never want to be in the way. But then also I don't want to, as a, like a woman and as a queer person, I don't want to shy away. I don't know. I'm a mess, John.
Sounds like you're perfect for television right. to me.
And Julia, Abby comes to you and says, I suspect yeah. some version of this statement. I'm doing this thing. I want you to be in it. And there's going to be this scene where I talk about how you ruined my life.
Yes.
And you're like, okay.
Yeah.
Not going to go talk to her.
Yeah, you should go tell her that she ruined your life. Get it over with and be done.
How do you see that going? Like, hi, Miss Sweeney. My name is Abby. Your character, Pat, that you played, who nobody could tell was a man or a woman, ruined my life. Have a good night.
Wait, what?
Yeah. That was the only joke of the whole premise.
No, I was actually happy to do it because I like to meet the people whose lives I've ruined. And try to start making some kind of amends. And this was the beginning of that opportunity.
I suspect Abby is probably not the first person who has issues with Pat from SNL. Is what happens in the show not totally unlike what might have happened in real life
well,
to you?
Nothing like that's happened exactly like
okay.
that. Because people don't say stuff to your face. You know, everyone just says, that was interesting. I have a friend who thought it was less interesting. Although they liked it, but were all, that's what people say. But, you know, yeah. I mean, of course I've had to stop and reckon with this character that I created that I still defend. You know, like I like it. But also I can see how with the culture and the zeitgeist got taken up in a way that I hadn't predicted. Actually, I had an analogy this morning that would be probably a terrible one. I'm like what I hate about Trump, where he says the things he says has no impact. He's just saying this thing that he believes is innocent. In a way, that was me. I did this character that to me what was... I never even cared about Pat's androgyny that much. I cared about playing this character that was based on a couple of guys who were really annoying, and I got to be annoying in that way.
Are you mad at me, Bill?
No, no. Why would I be mad at you?
I just thought you might be mad at me.
No, no, not at all, not quite sure how to address you.
No formalities here. Just call me Pat.
And then we threw in some androgyny jokes to make it interesting. And also because I couldn't really convincingly play a guy, it didn't seem like. But then the way it got taken off to be about making fun of people who were androgynous, which in my mind, it was always making fun of the people for whom they needed to know so much whether Pat was a man or a woman. Like all the jokes are actually about the other people being frustrated. But that in the larger sense, though, it was true that it was this androgynous character that was really not a flattering depiction of an androgynous character. So, but I, because I felt like my intentions were pure, I wasn't responsible for that, the culture taking it that way. Where over time, I thought, no, well, you kind of are. Like, this is something you created and the culture took off with it in a way that you didn't really expect. That wasn't completely great, and you're left with having created it. You know, like, so it's a really complicated thing.
We're talking with Abby McEnany and Julia Sweeney about their series, Pilot, Work in Progress. One of the things that I'm wondering about is, while this series is very personal to you, it also can be personal to a lot of people who haven't seen themselves represented this way. So What do you hope people who never get to see stories like this take away from it? Because these are not people we see anywhere often.
I mean, honestly, it's funny because I think definitely there's more queers on TV now, which is so beautiful. And I hope it's empowering. I don't even know. And I think even as a fat person, I you know, and like an older person, like an older masculine, heavy, queer woman who has mental illness. And like, I don't know. I just want to bring realness about like the people that we often see on TV are not what we see in real life. And I think I've had some people, I don't know, say like, this means a lot to me. I mean, maybe it was one person. It might have been my father. Listen, but I don't know. I just really hope that we bring a lot of stories about real people. And that's what I was kind of talked about. Somebody in an online thing was like, oh, and Abby McNeese said that she doesn't want to be pigeonholed as a queer show, and that's a disservice to the community and the show. And they took issue with that. And I was like, okay, that's fine. But also, I just like, I think when we start saying it's a queer show, then, wait. Then only queers are gonna, like, you know, then right. It's going to be, I'm like, I this is a show about human beings and maybe human beings they haven't seen before.
Well, and it's also about opportunity. And this is absolutely where it comes back, I think, to you, Julia, because I think one of the things that a lot of people don't know about you is that you left Saturday Night Live before you were obligated
yes,
to.
Exactly.
Because of opportunities, because yes. of what you and other female performers were allowed to do or
yes.
not allowed to do.
That's true.
And I think in some ways that's, you know, a mirror to this story, that you saw what it was like to not be able to tell the stories and be the performer
right.
or writer that you wanted to be.
Right. I mean, in some ways, I think that's such an other whole big long thing. But yeah, like my last year at SNL, the sketches were funny sketches, but all, you know, Adam Sandler, who I think is hilarious, Chris Farley, it was just all the guys. There were more women portrayed on SNL that season in drag by like Chris Farley and David Spade than there were actual women. Like they were literally only 3 women and 10 guys. And then we couldn't even get parts because the guys were in drag and also doing very, you know, making fun of women kind of, you know, performances. And it was incredibly frustrating. And my writing partner, who was from Second City too, you probably don't know her, Christine Zander, had left the show. And I was really adrift. It was a horrendous year. And I finally just quit before the end. Because it was just, I remember thinking I would rather clean toilets with a toothbrush somewhere to earn a living than be on this show, which is terrible. Which makes me nervous to say because I've had a long time to reconcile myself with the show. So I hope this doesn't ruin that. But now I'm kind of back in the fold somewhat. And, you know, I'm doing the show Shrill where I play Adie Bryant's mother. And it's been so much fun. And I've seen Lauren and we've chatted. So I feel like I'm back. And I feel like it took Tina Fey to revolutionize. It took someone of her level of genius and guts and persistence to revolutionize that show. And that was just before my time.
And Abby, was some of the motivation for creating Work in Progress, similar to what Julia's talking about, that you weren't getting the chance to tell the stories that you wanted to tell and that were important to you?
For sure. Yeah, I think that, yeah, absolutely. I think the only way I knew I really want to perform, and the only way I was going to perform was to write. And the only way, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to be a lead on a network sitcom, and that's cool.
Oh, yes, you are, baby.
No, I you know, and I just think I'm very realistic. I know what I look like. I know what I sound like. Yeah, that was the impetus to write and to create stories and that were real and vulnerable, which is very difficult, and put myself out there because it's the only way I will be able to do what I want to do, and that is to write and work. I just want to work.
Abby and Julia, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
John, this has been a treat. Thank you so much.
That was Abby McEnany and Julia Sweeney talking about their pilot episode of Work in Progress. And coming up, Anthony Wilson combines his passions for music and photography on his latest project.
I fell in love again. When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. And I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn. L.A.-based guitarist, arranger, and composer Anthony Wilson is the son of the late great jazz trumpeter, composer, and bandleader Gerald Wilson. While jazz is a foundation of sorts, Wilson has also accompanied Paul McCartney, Aaron Neville, and Willie Nelson. He's also been a member of Diana Krall's ensemble since 2001. Wilson's latest project combines his own music and his own photography. The Frame contributor Linnell George has this review.
Anthony Wilson's latest release, Songs and Photographs, reminds us what we've lost in our departure from the analog life, both in music and in snapshots that serve as rich repositories of emotion and memory. This new work is an album in the purest sense, an unfolding collection of images, both sonic and visual, meant to be taken as a whole, intended for reflection. For years now, Wilson's creative journeys have avoided strict labels. Songs and Photographs is no different. It's an assemblage of observations and revelations rolling through time and space. And accompanying it all is a sequence of quietly evocative photographs shot on film, taken from his journeys across the country and around the globe. The opening piece, The Palmist Hand, which you're hearing now, is an ebullient, shimmering, mystical mood. If Songs and Photographs were a film, this would be the establishing shot. You fall into its locomotion, its opening sonic vistas. And for this foray, not only has Wilson set down lyrics, he also provides the vocals. While We Slept feels like a journal entry, just Wilson's plaintive voice, first backed only by his guitar. And then the spare arrangement continues to build and fill in with colors until a lush instrumental section materializes, like an image shimmering up in a dark room's developing tray. Many of the compositions in Songs and Photographs render environments. They feel like navigable locales. We're rolling through time and space as if by train. Locations flash by, overtaken by the next. The compositions aren't sentiments. They are situations. We can experience them with all of our senses. Song from a Dream, which may be the most straight-ahead jazz cut on the album, features a luminous Gerald Clayton on piano, and it swings hard. Wilson is a tumbleweed, and over time he's collected bits and pieces of what he's traveled through, both as a player and an observer-listener. Laurel Canyon's introspections, Dark to Dawn mysterious opening vistas. Tune to tune, the album reveals Wilson's fluidity, his ease in many settings. He reaches for mood, the elements that might best relate the subject at hand. Maybe it's the simplicity of a single voice, maybe it's a jazz embellishment, or an unshakable New Orleans second line beat, as in Listen to My Heartbeat. It's all evidence of the journey. The photo sequencing establishes a complementary arc, a walkabout. The elegant accompanying book is an album of small gestures, incidental moments, and visual side chatter. Wilson's eloquent photographs, 22 in all, were shot with a 1959 Canon rangefinder. They record the small, often unnoticed details that, taken together, create an atmosphere. In the fraction of a second, the shutter opens and closes. It's his way, he sings in the title cut, Songs and Photographs, of taming chaos, slowing time.
Breathless, I sit watching as the blue hourglass drains. With my camera, I go out walking
Much like the ritual of walking, looking, and composing, Wilson's album entices the listener to slow down, to examine details and layers. A sky drained of color, an empty nest, the found poems within graffiti or ghost signs, reflections within reflection. In lyrics, he frames the tiniest of moments, colored pencils in a gold leaf case, the growth of a hedge, the act of recovering last night's dream, to create an album of moments and gestures. Wilson's act of observation shows us that everything we perceive is a continuous flow of experience. All that richness and those imperfections become the album we call our memories. We too are analog.
Dust in the finder, haze in the lens, perspectives that warp, shadows that bend.
As an artist, Wilson pushes beyond expectations, both the listener's and his own. Songs and Photographs is heedless of labels. It's what music would be if both record companies and consumers weren't compelled to affix or expect them. The result is a record that defies genre, proudly and boldly, full of unexpected turns and vivid introspective vistas. Songs and Photographs settles Wilson in a fertile creative landscape where, as he sings in While We Slept, there's no fear, and in this place where I have landed, can I take a look around and stay? For The Frame, I'm Linnell George.
That feature was beautifully mixed by The Frame's engineer, Valentino Rivera. And that's all for this week. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, and Andrea Gutierrez, with help this week from Julia Paskin. I'm Stephen Cuevas. John Horn is back here on Monday. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.